Hi, this is Tony from Springfield. I remember it was the first day of college. I was driving on 675 and was listening to the radio. I was talking to my mom, and on the radio it said a plane has crashed into the Twin Towers, and my heart just sank in my stomach, like, I don't know, fell. It was kind of strange. It was really surreal.
My name is Terry Hughes. I live in Brookville, and my wife and I were at Good Sam North when 9/11 happened, and all of a sudden, the reservists in uniform started taking off running. We were there for an appointment, and we couldn't figure out what was going on, except for there was military running all through the hospital, and they were running to leave to get back to base. After our appointment, we stopped to get breakfast, and they had a small TV, and that's when we saw the second plane hit the World Trade Center, and we just sat there in complete and utter disbelief. We didn't know what to think.
You're listening to A Clear Day in September, a remembrance of 9/11 in the Miami Valley. I'm Emily McCord. For the next hour, we'll hear some of the difficult stories as they unfolded 10 years ago, and then meet people as they remember those events today. We begin with WYSO former news director Eileen LeBlanc.
That morning, I washed my dishes before going to work. I usually did the dishes in the morning. I don't know why. Who can remember the details of a day 10 years ago? But I can remember doing the dishes that morning. It was 8:30 on a Tuesday, and I had to be at the station by 8:50. September the 11th, 2001, was going to be a busy day at WYSO. Shortly after 9, people began to hear about a small plane hitting one of the towers of the World Trade Center in New York. This is the wire. This is the AP wire, and it's time-stamped 9:17 on 9/11. Two planes have smashed into the World Trade Center in New York. A small aircraft crashed into the upper floors of one of the World Trade Center towers this morning. Witnesses report hearing a huge explosion, and heavy black smoke could be seen pouring out of the building. Wreckage can also be seen embedded in the upper floors of the skyscraper. Shortly afterward, a second plane hit the other tower. There is no word on any casualties. Copyright 2001 by the Associated Press. I went into Master Control and listened in queue to NPR, and then I crossfaded the World Cafe out and NPR on. Carrie Nolan from WNYC was reporting.
What we have now is that the Associated Press is saying that the FBI is investigating reports of a possible hijacking. If that's not the case, then the other scenario that's being sort of discussed is that the radar systems at one of the three airports in the area has gone horribly, horribly awry.
Are you, where are you exactly?
Actually, I can't even get into New York City.
At WYSO, the entire station, all eight of us became news people. I remember most of it as an adrenaline-driven blur which lasted for many days. We went on the air with whatever information we could find, whenever we could find it.
We have increased security at all state buildings with the help of the Highway Patrol. We have activated our Emergency Operations Center to coordinate our efforts, and the Ohio National Guard has been placed on high alert status.
We were very fortunate that we did receive a little notification from the FAA that we had 18 flights that were diverted here that were actually headed to destinations around the country. And when we got that notification, the airlines immediately dispatched buses. We got as many cabs as we could from various parts of the city. We got all the rental cars involved and put on standby to have every available car. And by very quickly, the passengers that were sent to Dayton were quickly sent to hotels or put on buses and taken to their destinations.
What is the security status right now at the airport?
Well, at this time, the checkpoint is closed. Only employees that have an airport-issued ID are allowed beyond checkpoint.
Jerry Winhoven was 24 and at a training session with Morgan Stanley in New York. His friend Marcia Hudson was supposed to be there, too. Marcia came to WISO to help us out, and she called Jerry at his hotel in New York. We woke him at 7 a.m. on September the 12th.
We're talking with Jerry Winhoven, who was in on the 61st floor of the World Trade Center building yesterday morning. He lives in Dayton. Is that correct, Jerry?
Yes.
And you have family here?
I have family in Salina. I was getting coffee, still trying to wake up because it was still pretty early. We had started about 7:30. We took a break about 8:40, and I think the first impact was right around 8:45.
In the other building?
And actually, it hit the other building. It was on the opposite side. So
Did you see or feel that impact?
We could feel it, and I was actually, like I said, I was away from the windows, but it sounded like I heard windows break. So I actually went to the room that I was in, and several of our windows had cracked, and some had actually even fell through. I went up to these windows, and I could actually stick my head out the World Trade Center on the 61st floor. It was an amazing sight. But all I could see, and I couldn't see the ground or anything. All I could see was almost like a bird's eye view of a ticker tape parade. In essence, it really was. It was just documents and papers, and it was all coming from behind us and slightly above us. They instructed us to just grab what we could and take off. So we just started heading down the stairwell, so to speak, from the 61st floor. Got down to about the 30th floor or so when they actually had made an announcement that it was the other building and that we were secure.
Mm-hmm.
And that, we, you know, if we'd like, we could go ahead and go back up to our offices or whatever. I don't know anyone that did. I don't know if anybody were there so close to their office that they did. They went ahead and stayed when they made that announcement. I hope God they didn't. But we all were just like, no, I'm just getting out of here. It's just something that I didn't really want to be a part of, to be quite honestly with you. People were still in a pretty calm manner at that point because nobody really had known what had happened. But then I get down to about the 18th floor. It had been about another 5 or 6 minutes or so. And that's when our building, I guess, had gotten hit. I didn't know what it was at the time, but it just felt almost like an earthquake. It was just, I mean, it knocked about all of us fell down the stairs on the way down. And at that point, it was more of a panic situation at that point. Everybody was kind of for themselves, just trying to get down the staircase as fast as possible. And all I was doing is the math, and I'm on the 18th floor, I'm still 180 feet up, and that's still a long way to fall. I got down to the bottom floor where there was, basically, there's just a large mall down there, and I would say it's probably equivalent to about the size of like Fairfield Mall, and it was just going from one end to the other. It's really how many twists and turns that we had to make to get out of here, and there were just people who would exit you out. In essence, say they were—I don't know if they were working for the building or they were firemen at the time, firefighters or what they were, but they were helping us to get out, and they were pointing, and everybody in the building was like, you know, calm. But once I got to the outside and I saw some of the firemen outside, and everybody was looking up, and the lady was actually at the window, just the fright in her eyes, and then I knew I was really a part of something amazing, and I got out, and it was just like just debris everywhere. I mean, I could see there were, like, periodically I would see bodies down, and there was blood everywhere, and I didn't know if they were hurt from the debris. I don't know if they were some of the people that had supposedly jumped, which I didn't really see any of that firsthand, but when I'd gotten away, I just got about a block or two away, and I looked up, and that's when I just saw, you know, our building just on fire. It was absolutely, like I said, it was incredible. I didn't want to be close to that. I didn't want anywhere near it. I just thank God that I was out of there, and I just continued to run. I got about 8 blocks up. I just had about $30 cash on me, so what I was going to do was actually ask just an individual, you know, hey, can I ride with you north? Here's $30. Just take me that way, you know, just as long as I get in the area to get to my hotel and let my friends and family know that I was okay. And when I went to do that, I actually turned around and there was a cab. It was just amazing that there was a cab with nobody in it because so many people were watching this thing that nobody was getting in a cab. And so I hopped in a cab, and I remember turning around. As soon as I turned around to look, that's when our whole building just collapsed. I was like 6 or 8 blocks away, and I just said, go, go, go.
You know, to this day, I get asked often if I have dreams and nightmares about the account, and I have some mild ones, but nothing that really negatively impact me, just because for the majority of my of me descending down the building and getting out, I was lucky enough to really not know what was going on.
Jerry Winhoven lives in Salina now, close to his family and friends. I'm Emily McCord. And when I talked to him recently, he says he looks back on the events of that day and says the whole experience just blindsided him.
I guess it was a kind of a big wake-up call for myself and to America on, you know, as great a country as this is, just take some little things to really start to try to tear America apart. And with the unfortunate events of 9/11, I really felt that it really did the opposite and really brought a lot of people together.
Do you still feel that sense of unity in the country, or do you think things have changed?
I do still feel the sense of unity. I think the further away you get from it, I think, you know, it's easy to kind of have that diminishing feeling from the U.S., but I assure you, when I go to watch the Super Bowl and they're playing, you know, the national anthem, everybody's teared up. I mean, I have a good idea what they're thinking about. So there are always constant reminders. Do we think about it, you know, 24 hours a day, maybe like we did, you know, in the first couple months after 9/11? Maybe not, but I do remember the firefighters and trying to go around us and go up each floor, and I still think to this day, every day, you know, I didn't think much of it at the time, but, you know, obviously all those gentlemen had lost their lives. And, you know, that's one of the things that I still think about 10 years later.
I'm Eileen LeBlanc. It had been a clear day in September. And for me, it had been all about work, worry, and the worst images I ever wanted to see. 12 hours after I had left my apartment, I headed home. It was an utter shock to see that Yellow Springs looked normal. How out of place it was to see a young girl rollerblading on the bike path. But there was a traffic jam and long lines of headlights at the BP station well into the night. As the days went by, an ever-changing set of pictures emerged as the Miami Valley and Ohio reacted and responded.
A friend of mine told me that the price of gas is supposed to go up $6 a gallon, between $5 and $6 a gallon.
It's $5 and some odd cent out, no bets.
The rumors is tomorrow price is supposed to be up to $6. $6. I can't pay no $100 for no full tank of gas.
And I know on Sinclair Road that it was $2.58 a gallon already, and I've seen where it's only $1.45, and they were saying that the gas prices were going to go up like $5 or $6 tomorrow.
So you're trying to beat the price hike?
Yo, definitely. It's too bad they have to take a tragedy and turn it into something like this, though.
Do you think that by everybody coming here to get the gas, it's causing the situation that you're trying to avoid?
Right.
Do not panic. There is adequate supply from all information we have there that we're not out of gasoline. Our problem is when you do panic buy, and then stations run out of gasoline, and it takes time to get more gasoline to those stations. And we're telling people, don't panic. There is gasoline. There is supply. You have no need to rush out and fill up your car.
No knives of any size beyond the security checkpoint. Again, heretofore, there was the pocket knife, permission to you have a pocket knife with you and bring it on board. But from this point forward, no knives of any shape or size, makeup at all are permitted beyond the security checkpoints. An increase in screening of passengers and baggage at the security checkpoint. I think you'll also see an increase in the hand search of carry-on luggage.
It seems normal now, doesn't it? Taking off your shoes, being wanded, not going to the gate without a ticket. But security issues on those days in September of 2001 were not so every day. There was concern about Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which employed 22,000 civilians and military at the time. We talked with Lieutenant General Richard Reynolds, who is commander of Aeronautical Systems Center, or ASC, his job 10 years ago.
We're basically locked down. People don't go on and off the base. People stay in their, in their facilities, stay in their buildings, not to transit the base and so forth. So within a matter of an hour or so, we were at our highest security level and stayed there for the remainder of the day.
What does that highest security level mean?
Well, it means that we're actually under attack, okay? And the main focus is force protection, is keeping the people safe.
I'm Emily McCord, and the task of keeping people safe also fell on Vince Russo's shoulders. He was in charge of acquisitions, but that day he was also a high-ranking civilian on base. So while the essential personnel were on lockdown, non-essential civilians were asked to leave. What sticks out in Russo's memory are the long traffic jams getting out of the base. And at the end of an exhausting day, he goes home, and he's standing outside with his neighbors. And everyone wants to talk to him because he works on base, and they think he might know something.
All of a sudden, a jet goes by with sonic boom. And you, oh my God, what the heck's that? You know, somebody is going to do something. But you know, you don't hear sonic booms around this place very much. I haven't heard them in years. Never did figure out where that airplane went, what he was doing. But you know, it's just the faster the airplane goes, if you go past Mach 1, the speed of sound, you'll create a sonic boom. Well, most airplanes don't fly that fast. Even the jets around here that can, they don't when they're over civilian populations because of the boom issue. But this guy did. So, someone said that the legend is that he was going to protect the president. I don't know if that's true or not. Yeah, that's a legend. But that's what I heard. But I did hear the boom that day.
And when Russo went to sleep that night, the events of the day hadn't yet sunk in for him. He talked to his family. Everybody was okay. But so much had happened, and he'd been so busy.
I honestly, as I look back 10 years, was not that worried. I thought it was an isolated incident that we would get to the root of it, like the Oklahoma City bombing or something like that. I thought it was an isolated incident. I didn't view it as it's going to be a major attack on a country, and you know, my life is in danger or your life's in danger. I didn't think that at all. And as things unfolded, though, then I did start worrying a little more. I think I was more concerned weeks and months later than I was that actual night as to what was really going on.
Freedom and democracy are under attack. The American people need to know we're facing a different enemy than we have ever faced. This enemy hides in shadows and has no regard for human life. This is an enemy who preys on innocent and unsuspecting people, then runs for cover. But it won't be able to run for cover forever. This is an enemy that tries to hide, but it won't be able to hide forever. This is an enemy that thinks its harbors are safe, but they won't be safe forever. This enemy attacked not just our people, but all freedom-loving people everywhere in the world. The United States of America will use all our resources to conquer this enemy. We will rally the world. We will be patient. We will be focused. And we will be steadfast in our determination. This battle will take time and resolve. But make no mistake about it, we will win.
It was the week of September the 11th. I'm Eileen LeBlanc. At WYSO, we took phone calls from listeners every day for about 5 days. The early calls were more angry and full of frustration. Some wanted to drop bombs and pay them back. Violence was reported, including on a mosque near Cleveland. Later, the calls became more reflective and emotional. People were weary of this new life. They needed to get back to work and do something, to fix it, to get back to normal. People said that a lot.
Yes. Yes, I'd like to make a comment. I'm a truck driver, and I drive the 48 states. Happened to be coming through Washington yesterday about 2 in the morning, so I didn't get that backup in the traffic, and I couldn't see anything. But once I saw it on TV, I noticed, you know, we're talking about black and white and color and individuals. If you noticed, if you were able to watch TV yesterday, a lot of people that were helping people, you had white people helping black people, you had men and women. You know, there wasn't a color, there wasn't an issue of race. It was just, we were all Americans. And that was my comment. As Americans, we united under tragedy.
Thanks for your call.
Also concerned about is the language that we use in describing
what we wish to do to the people who have committed these crimes. For example, President Bush says that we should hunt down the criminals. There's a sense in which we view these people not only as cultural others, but as animals. And I think that's frightening. And maybe we should think about how that relates to folks dancing the street of Palestine.
It's really tough. You know, I'm nobody. I'm just another person out here in America working and trying to make a living. And, you know, and thousands and thousands and thousands of people in New York are suffering. And, you know, and it's, I think what America wants, and I know what I want, is I want revenge. And, you know, it's, unfortunately, you know, you feel like that, but gosh, that's what you really want. You want revenge, you know, you want to go after the people that are laughing and dancing and giving away candy in the streets, and, you know, that's the part that hurts.
What we could do to turn this tragedy around, and I think it's an opportunity to show patriotism in many ways. In one way, I think if you have stock, you should not sell it. You should buy. You should buy, and build the market up. You should, if you're a consumer, you should go out and buy everything you can to build the economy. You should donate money to the disaster fund. And if you have plans, once this air thing is lifted, you should go ahead with them. I'm personally afraid. I'm supposed to fly out today, and I'm going to fly out. I can maybe fly out tomorrow to go to a friend's wedding in Seattle. And I'm really scared to go, but I feel it's my duty to go, because if you don't go, if you change your plans, you're making them win twice.
Mm-hmm.
They win by killing us, and then they win by killing the spirit of everybody else in this country. And I really, really think that everybody shouldn't change their plans. You should go out and buy everything and do what you would normally do and show them that they can't kill the American spirit.
I'm Emily McCord, and you're listening to A Clear Day in September, a remembrance of 9/11 in the Miami Valley. If you've missed any part of today's program, you can find it online at wyso.org. Dave Tritch is a retired firefighter from the city of Kettering, and he's with the Ohio Task Force. Before 9/11, their job was to respond to natural disasters like earthquakes and hurricanes. Since then, they now also perform search and rescue in the case of terrorist attacks. That morning was typical for Dave. He went to the station, the TV's on, and he watches the news. He sees the first plane hitting one of the towers. And at this point, he's thinking like a fireman. Was it equipment failure, a medical issue? But when he saw the second plane hit, he knew it wasn't an accident.
And then somebody turned to me and said, "Do you think you'll be going?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean going?" "Well, the task force, the search and rescue team, do you think you'll be going there?" I said, "This is a building on fire. You know, this isn't a collapsed structure. I mean, it's a disaster in itself, but it's New York." Shortly thereafter that the first tower came down, and that's when I realized that this is going to be something far beyond what the city of New York Fire Department can actually handle. So it was at that point I was pretty much, you know, settling in my mind that this is something that a search and rescue team could end up going to. It was actually about 11:20 in the morning when one of the phones rang. When I answered it, it was Washington. It was the FEMA headquarters in Washington. And their words were just describing the incident with the impact on the World Trade Center. And, you know, we also have planes that have impacted the Pentagon. And, you know, your team would be assigned, should you accept the mission, to go to the World Trade Center. Will you accept the mission? At 5:30 in the evening, we were rolling towards New York. We've got an 80-person team. It is not a mandatory program for anyone to be involved with. It's voluntary. So everyone we have, they want to be there. If they don't want to be there, they aren't. And other people will fill their positions. We take 15 vehicles down the road with semi-trucks and carrying, you know, loads of equipment, more than you can ever imagine. And we also carry canines to be able to do search operations. When we were arriving in New York, I had never been there before. This was my first visit. So it was rather unique in that respect. And as we arrived, all the pictures I'd ever seen of New York on television and magazines, it's crowded with people. The cars are crowding highways and streets. It's a nightmare to drive. We're driving into New York, and there's not a single car visible anywhere. We're the only ones on a six-lane highway. And once we arrived at the actual site, what we were seeing was where Tower One stood. It was now, instead of 110 stories, it was about 5 to 7 stories high of a pile of rubble. And as you would get closer to it, you actually would see that there was a hole that went about 3 to 4 stories below ground, because the World Trade Center complex actually not only had the towers that extended above ground, but you had the entire mall area as well as subway tunnels and parking area that went below grade. So it was almost as if you were looking down into a canyon, and on the other side of the canyon, it extended up into a mountain. And it was nothing but debris and rubble. Smoke, fire, a lot of noise, heavy equipment moving and machinery. And so it was a very surreal experience to be able to see all of that up front the first time. The missions were always focused on trying to find some sign of survival. And, our team personally did not find any survivors. So we were just a tool, again, for NYPD, FDNY, to be able to locate whatever we could. If we did find a victim, if we did find a fatality, especially if it was a New York firefighter, we would identify them. We would never remove them. We would always make sure that the fire department was made aware. And it was out of courtesy for them to take care of their own. And at that point, we would step aside and let their firefighters move in and remove, their brother or sister firefighters. Your focus is on performing the task, and later on, the reality of things kind of starts to filter through. I've had several people that were very experienced, what I thought were very qualified people, that after 9/11 left the team. They said they just couldn't do it anymore. I had one man that went up with us, and the second day he picked up and found his own way and went back home. He said, "I can't work in this environment. It's unsafe." When we hit the road and we started at home, it was a casual drive home. We didn't no longer had the police escort. But when we hit the borders coming into Ohio, overpasses, every overpass that we went under, there were people standing up with signs. There were flags hanging. They were always referencing, heroes. But we're not a hero. We weren't the ones that were 60 stories up in the building and carried people down and got them out. We went in to pick up the pieces.
My name is John Titus. I'm the father of Alicia Nicole Titus, who was on the second plane and hit the South Tower on September 11th, 2001.
I'm Bev Titus and mother of Alicia. Alicia was 28 when she was killed.
Alicia was the oldest of 4 children. She was born in 1973, the summer of, while I was still a college student.
Her growing up, she was always very sweet and compassionate and caring for all people, and she was happy. She loved to read, and she loved writing, and she knew from the time she was in seventh grade that she wanted to attend Miami University, and which she did. She graduated from there, and she used to say, "Why can't we all just get along?" That was her theme, I guess. She could not stand arguments or disagreements. However, she loved having conversations and dialogues, even if you didn't agree. And in the morning of September 11th, I had gone to bed late. I'd taken my grandson back to Ohio, and Alicia had planned on coming home to help care for him that day, but she couldn't get off of work because she was new and low on the totem pole, so she had to work. And I got home late, but I was awakened in the morning by this energy that was literally pulling me out of bed and was telling me to wake up. And I remember saying, no, I just want to lay here for a few more minutes. I'm tired. And as if I was talking to somebody, which seemed so strange. And then I closed my eyes again and tried to go back to sleep. And this energy literally pulled me out of bed. And I said, okay, I'll get up. So I got up and turned on the TV, which I rarely did because I had to get ready for work. And I went and made coffee and sat down just in time to see the second plane hit. And I could not believe my eyes. It was like watching a horror film.
I was at work at Schoolcraft College in Livonia, Michigan, and I was leading a staff meeting when a coworker came in and turned a TV on, and just in time to see the second plane hit the South Tower and burst into a big ball of flame. Little did I know at that point that that was Alicia's plane, and I had this sinking feeling, and I remember feeling this wave of empathy and compassion for those people who were affected directly by that. But I was in denial and wouldn't even entertain the idea that my daughter might have been on that plane.
In the midst of that, I kept thinking I needed to call my son. It was his birthday, and he was in Montana, so I had to wait to make sure it wasn't too early. But I started getting phone calls. Our daughter, Shanoa, called, and she was crying and afraid that Alicia was on the plane, and I assured her that she was okay and just part of my denial. And her boyfriend called, Greg, and he was concerned, and so I told them that I would call her roommates. She had an apartment in Boston with four other flight attendants, and four of the five flew out that morning. And the one that was still at the apartment, she was asleep, and I woke her up, and she didn't know what was going on, and she said but she would start making some calls to find out. So I just started getting ready for work, and I went into work, and the whole way there, I kept thinking, you know, every person I saw, I needed to smile and let them know it was going to be okay. In spite of what was going on, you know, that we had to be able to love each other and show compassion, and I still wouldn't allow myself to consider the idea that Alicia was on the plane.
And so throughout the morning, it was just we would get another clue that maybe she was on that. And then Bev, we came together at probably around 11 o'clock, and then started calling places and receiving more phone calls before we decided to head home. And I remember the look of compassion and fear and empathy from my coworkers as we walked out the door for our 45-minute drive home. And as we walked in the door of our home, the phone was ringing incessantly, and it was our son, Zach, who lived in Montana, and United Airlines had called him, and he gave us the news, which just floored us. I remember wailing and crying out and just couldn't believe what we had just heard. And then I had to go to Dexter High School to get my youngest son from the school, and I had to do that right away. So I took leave and went into town and got him and came back.
And when he came home, he was screaming. And just 18. and he fell to his knees. And he said he wanted to kill them. And I told him that we could not do the same thing that they had done to us. And I realized later that I didn't want to discount what my son had felt. And I apologized to him for that, if I did that, but I just shared that we needed to do something different to break that cycle of violence. And that it was important for us to be able to embrace our feelings no matter what they were, and but then to figure out what to do with that so they didn't destroy us or kill us like they had Alicia.
The last 10 years has been a journey for us, a very difficult journey, and I think for our whole country in many ways. When we look at where we were then, before September 11th, and where we are now, it looks completely different. We've been at war for 10 years. Our fourth graders in school, that's all they've known in their world is United States at war. I think that people have had time to reflect upon that, and was that the right path to take? And many will justify it and say that it was. But many of us also will look back and say, maybe there was a better way.
It's too late for my daughter, but it's not too late for me to do something for the rest of my children and their children and their grandchildren and their grandchildren. And the time is now for us to do something different. And we choose to create a culture of peace, and we'll do everything that we can for the rest of our lives to be a part of that movement.
A clear night came to us here in the Miami Valley. The skies were quiet, but you could count on the cicadas. Hundreds of candles sparkled through the buggy darkness at a vigil arranged by Antioch students. Almost out of earshot, a single musician, Noah Diamond.
A lot of things happen today that will shape our lives for better or for worse for the rest of our being. There's nothing we can do to ignore this and nothing we can do to silence it. And so I just thought it would be right to, I don't know, maybe give a last farewell to the people who died. Like the song that I played originally was intended as a funeral procession, but through my life, I've seen it more as a rebirth song, a song that signifies maybe the death of something, and that song kind of makes me think of a tree sprouting up through burnt soil. Maybe I played it to, you know, say goodbye to the people who died, but maybe I played it as an act of good faith so we don't go into the next step of this whole cycle in a thinking in a revenge sort of way or a let's get even sort of way, but more of a healing sort of way. I think that's why I played what I did.
Is peace possible? Yes. Peace is possible. It is the only way you can achieve big goals without bloodshed.
Dr. Khurshid Ahmad serves on the board of the Dayton Peace Museum. He remembers the climate of discrimination he felt in the Miami Valley after 9/11, and he's been an advocate in the community for peace and social justice ever since. He was also a retired Wright State University professor.
After 9/11, just maybe after a month or so, I received a call from my student. He's from Bombay, see? And he said, Dr. Ahmad, I need your help. I said, what's the problem? And he said, my brother and I, we were having a dinner in front of Dayton Mall. And he said, this husky big guy came to our table, okay? And he said, are you Muslims? My student said, you know, this is a private matter. You know, whether I'm Muslim or Christian, why you're interested? And he said, you are Muslim. That's why you are not telling. So my student pulled out a cross and he showed. He said, I'm not a Muslim. I'm Christian. Look, this cross I'm wearing. And the guy got even more agitated and angry. He said, you are a Muslim and trying to hide behind this cross. So don't give me this BS, he said. And he said, you come out and I will blow your head off. I have a gun in my car. And the waitress was listening to this conversation and she got scared and she went to the manager of the restaurant. You know, he called the police station, Mammothburg. And the policeman totally ignored the guy, you know, who threatened and went to these two brothers. And the manager came and said, this guy didn't do anything. But still, you know, the policeman took them to the police station. And they were scared, you know. And finally, you know, he gave them a ticket for disturbing the peace. And then, you know, the case was dismissed because there was no substance to it. And I have, you know, gotten so many other personal things too, like my son during the same period of time, you know, driving, and somebody, you know, came next to his car, shouted, you know, and run him off the road. He said, you go back where you came from. We don't want you. The discrimination is here. It hasn't gone away. And I have a hope in America, you see, because the younger generation is very, very different than in the generation, which my generation and the parents, the grandparents, with the older generation, the way they grew up, they are carrying, you know, some of the seeds of hatred, dislike, distrust. So the brighter days are ahead. We should not be all dismayed and, you know, gloomy, you see.
Educating the next generation is constantly on the mind of P.R. Frank. He's a high school teacher in Dayton, and he wants his students to know what happened on 9/11. And that's why every spring, he takes them to Ground Zero.
Some students that we take don't know too much about the attack. They go there and they say, oh, it's called Ground Zero. Why do they call it Ground Zero? What were the World Trade Centers? What are these buildings? I think maybe they were too young to understand all of that when the news was heavy with it. This last year when we went to New York in the spring, we went to Ground Zero, and it was maybe 9 or 10 o'clock at night. It was very difficult to see anything because they have a lot of walls up now while they're building the new memorial, and the walkway to be able to see it is closed. But on our way back, we stopped by the fire station right there at Ground Zero. The doors were open, and there was a fireman leaning against the wall and just enjoying the nice evening. And so I encouraged my students to ask him questions. So they talked to this man, And they talked to several other firefighters there about their experiences about 9/11, why they are firefighters. And it brought several of my students to tears to listen to these firefighters talk about brothers in the firefighting brigade that lost their lives on September 11th. We walk around the corner from this fire station, and there is a mural on the wall that's a carving made out of maybe bronze. Looking at this memorial, this bronze sculpture, really took some of our students back and put them into a meditative mode. I was glad to see these students really start to understand what happened on that day. And the tears told the story. They were really moved by it and had a lot of questions after we left there and really wanted to talk about it. So I am pleased that I can give them that opportunity. After September 11th, I think I work harder in my classroom to talk to students about relationships that I have with people from around the world, with people from much different backgrounds than we grow up with, and how just giving somebody a chance, talking to people from other backgrounds, can give them an understanding of how we might better be able to get along. Even if we have differences, there are also similarities. And I want my students to look for those similarities so they can make connections with other people that they don't know or don't understand and be able to broker some peace.
This is 91.3 WYSO, public radio for the Miami Valley, and you're listening to A Clear Day in September, a remembrance of 9/11 and the Miami Valley. I'm Emily McCord. If you've missed any part of this program, you can find it online at our website at wyso.org. Friday, September 15th, 2001, was the National Day of Prayer, and at a church in downtown Dayton, people came to pay their respects.
Montgomery, I work at the city of Dayton. Well, I've come here because I think it'll be a moment to acknowledge what has happened in our country and to pray for the victims and their families, as well as kind of a national day of atonement for all of us, a day when we can realize that no matter what divisions we thought separated us, that we're really a lot closer than I think we are.
My name is Barry Holbrook. I'm the Assistant Chief of Emergency Services with the Dayton Fire Department. We're here at the 138 East First Street, the First Lutheran Church, to attend a prayer service dedicated to the individuals that have been involved with the incident and incidents in Washington, D.C., New York City, and Pennsylvania this weekend or this week. We want to be here to pay our respects, to stand along those that are on the front lines out there performing the service to rescue, to search, and to continue to work and try to uncover anyone that may still be in the rubble there. We hope and pray that there are members there that are still alive and that we'll be able to uncover them and rescue them.
My name's Rick Powell, Pastor Rick Powell here at First Lutheran Church, and what it is we're hoping to accomplish is to let go and let God, listen to His word, remember that He's God and we're not. We're resisting opinions. We're resisting trying to be hotshot intellectuals or politicos. We want to praise God even in the midst of this terrible tragedy. We want to give thanks to God for being with us every step of the way.
It would be difficult for me to imagine that any person of faith didn't struggle with what happened, because it was too big for anyone to really take in. I mean, 10 years later, we're still processing what happened. I'm Sherry Blackwell. I am the pastor at the Yellow Springs United Methodist Church. When something is that horrible, at first for me it came down to how could people be that bad, and then it shifted to how could God let this happen, and then it shifted to but God was present. And for me, not only was God present in the tragedy, God, you could see God at work throughout the tragedy. That kind of human behavior, we have choices that we are allowed to make, but it doesn't mean that God is not touched by what we do, or that God is impassive, or that God just stands back and watches it happen. I think God was very present. I really believe that God was weeping with us.
By the end of that week, Eileen LeBlanc had been working nonstop, and reflection had mixed with exhaustion. On that Friday, WYSO aired an essay that Eileen wrote.
When I got home on Tuesday night, the dishes were still in the drainer on the sink where I had left them to dry early that morning. A cobalt blue glass bowl, a plastic container, a few forks and knives, and a cream-colored pot in which I had made the new nectar for my hummingbird feeder. A simple task, washing up Tuesday morning before I left for work. An everyday task done on an everyday. Those dishes on my sink were dry when I got home on Tuesday night, and as I reached to put them away routinely, my hand stopped. I couldn't touch them. At that moment, I let out the tears I'd been ignoring since the morning when, after our shock and emotion, we had to go to work. No time for feelings. The day filled with the hardest work at a time when you just wanted to stop and grieve. Those dishes on my sink were of another time. They represented a time when everything was pretty much okay, when my worries and work were kind of easy to deal with, when I was comfortable, protected. It had not been yet 12 hours since I had washed those dishes, and the whole world had changed. I could not disturb the still life display, the portrait of a life back then. It's Friday, and those dishes still sit, collecting a little bit of dust now. But it's time now to plan for the days ahead. It's time now to find ways to help each other. This country, indeed, the world has been violated. But oddly, the violation has united us. Under a flag, behind a might, over despair. I am proud to have been born in this country. And you have made me proud that I live right here in Ohio. Tomorrow, I will begin to work on stories which celebrate the wonderful people of the Miami Valley, their talent, their hard work, and their care. Tonight, I will go home and climb the stairs and put my dishes away.
John, Yellow Springs. 9/11 really hit me hard. I was like shattered after that. I felt so vulnerable, you know, and like scared in crowds and didn't want to be around tall buildings because I thought a plane might crash into them. Didn't like low flying planes. But what I wound up doing was I started in my garden building things out of stone and mortar and reinforced concrete. And like, that gave me this peace, and I wanted something that was really strong and really indestructible and would last. And I've been doing that for 10 years now, and it's like really became my like my therapy after 9/11. And now I've got these structures in my garden that, you know, kind of like my personal, like, memorial.
My name is Steve Greenblatt, living here in Centerville. I was a witness to 9/11 from probably not more than 21, 22 blocks away on the day that it happened. I try not to dwell on it because it does depress me. I don't feel obligated to sit and grieve and shed a tear and that sort of stuff. I'm remembering it. I'll never forget it, but by the same token, you know, you do have to move on with your life.
My name is Julie, and I'm in Dayton. I feel like the fear around that event is still being utilized to influence people. So I just hope that our country and our communities can make good decisions and not decisions just based on fear around those events that happened now 10 years ago.
Tom Norris. I live in Dayton, Ohio, since 9/11 happened. I was laid off making car parts and right after that. And from then on, I've been working at a recycling plant. 10 years, that's the longest I've ever worked at the place. Love my place. I just wish we'd go to peace instead of all this crazy war. But I just wish the war would get over. But other than that, it has completely changed my life since 9/11. I mean, I don't make car parts no more. Thank you so much. Bye.
My name is Vince Russo. They said 3,000 of our fellow citizens got killed that day. You know, killed. I mean, they were murdered. They weren't just accidentally died or a consequence of a major war. They were purposely murdered. So there's no way we ought to be forgetting that kind of stuff. But also, you know, it can happen again. That'd be my biggest worry. Will it happen again? Could it happen again? Where's it going to happen again? You know, those kind of things.
My name is Dave Trich, and I'm a retired firefighter from City of Kettering. I still travel quite a lot for business. I still have on my laptop, the image on my laptop is still the Twin Towers with flames rolling out of them. And I've had a lot of people stop as I'm flying, and they'll see the image on my screen and stop and ask me questions and talk about it. I've had a few people that have said, well, why do you even want that on there? Why don't you just want to forget it? And I hear so many people say, well, you just need to forget those things and move on. Well, I don't want to forget it. It's not that I want to remember bad memories, but I don't want people to become so complacent because of the fact that it's past, it's over, it's done. You know, why dwell on it? I'm not going to dwell on it. I just will never forget it.
You've been listening to A Clear Day in September. Wayne Baker, Sarah Buckingham, Juliet Frumholtz, and Jerry Kenny contributed to this special. Thank you to Steve Lucht, Vic McCunis, Nikki Dakota, and the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, and to all of the listeners who called in with their comments. And a special thanks goes to Eileen LeBlanc. Nina Ellis is the editor. I'm Emily McCord. More information about the Alicia Titus Memorial Peace Fund is available at sweetalicia.org. If you've missed any part of this program, you can find it online at wyso.org.